Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Peter Messer.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the British.
Yeah.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we're going to have a couple of topics under discussion. And we're also going to catch up with a man who I think puts the whole issue of brands in sport into a really simple context. And that is David Mitchell. He runs a company called DNA-RB in the United Kingdom. And he's been involved with sports people, championship winning teams, inventors, performers, and helping them create and manage strong brands which basically add to their value of themselves and their companies, and also the perception that they have in the public market. And we're going to look at that from a sports perspective rather, as to whether individual brands are getting bigger than the national association brand or the teams that they play for, which I think has really come to the fore of late, John.
Yeah, I would agree. There's and sponsorship in sports been a bit of an issue recently, and exactly what power a sponsor does have.
Indeed. Well, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And am I starting us off? I'm just going to turn our attention, I think, to football.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, first of all, surprise, surprise, Kenny Lowe was moved sideways. Now, some people are saying that him taking on the role at the academy was a good move to keep him involved in the club. A lot of other people are saying it was basically because the club couldn't afford to pay out his contract. We'll let that one, let our listeners decide what the case is there. But I think the terrifying thing again is another bad season, another coach shown the door. The club really is, you just wonder where it's going. And to me, one of the things that was handled really badly, the club have since been in touch with me after the piece I wrote, because I was saying I find it incredible that they get rid of the coach, the CEO then announces that he's leaving as well, and then they tell us that they're signing players. Now, it turns out that those players had in fact been signed before the end of the season. Then why not say that? Especially if you're thinking about sacking the coach, because the backfires on you when people find out that you're, it looks like you're signing players after the coach has left. Now, to me, if you've signed a player, then just let us know. And they're saying that this was the club's reasoning, was a decision was made because those players, it might have affected those players who were not going to be offered a new contract. Well, the way it works usually in football, John, is 3 months out from the end of the season and your contract expiring, the club can tell those players whether they're going to offer them a contract or not. They can start negotiations, or the player is welcome to talk to other clubs. So you think if you're sitting there and the club isn't offering you a contract, you know 3 months out from the end of the season whether they... So I'm sorry, but that story or that reasoning just doesn't fly with me.
No.
My personal view is, look, it's great that Tony Sage has put his money into the club, kept it afloat, but it is now definitely time he moved on. Forget trying to keep 10, 20%. No one who's buying it is ever going to accept that, especially where the club is now. They're going to see what you've done with it, Mr. Sage, and they're going to say, no, I don't want a part of it if you're still in the background. He needs to just walk away, and they need to find a new owner.
From what I understand, is he's had plenty of offers before. It's not as
if you believe what the media says.
Yeah, well, it's not as if there hasn't been some interest, but no one's been prepared to take on the debt and pay money.
Yeah, and I mean, you've sort of hit the... I know a couple of people that were interested in it, and the problem was that the money that was being discussed, in their words, was unrealistic.
Yeah.
For what the club is, the state it's in, not just the state, where it's performing, the crowd levels. Again, you know, I've been on about this for a long time, John, and I think that every sport in this country should be made to declare how many free tickets they give away to sporting events, because it does give a false impression of where how a club is travelling. Now, I know that the Glory was having 3,000 tickets every game that were being available for free. And what you're doing is there are people now who are waiting for those tickets and they won't buy a ticket. So, you know, you're actually damaging yourselves anyway by doing that. But let's be honest, the A-League is in a real bad state as well, because if you look at the state of things, the crowds for the finals were just diabolical. I mean, to be fair, Newcastle had 19,131 for their semi-final in a stadium that holds 33,000, but for Sydney to get just 17,775
against Melbourne,
yeah,
in a final
when the stadium holds 45,500. Now the average crowd for the season in the A-League was 10,671. That was across all the teams in the league. So if you look at that, you go, oh, those crowds aren't too bad. But when you look at, you know, Sydney's average for the season was 14,888. They only got 3,000 people came through the door for a finals game. Only 3,000 more people came through the gate.
What was their highest crowd, by the way?
I don't have that handy with me at the moment.
Because I know sometimes, you know, we've seen these one-off games where, say, Victory plays Melbourne City and they'll get 40,000. And then the next week, 10,000 will turn up. And if, you know, they talk about what the crowd figure might be, but, you know, yourself, when you do these sorts of statistics, you take your lowest and the highest out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the scary thing is if we look at those figures and Sydney is meant to be the blue ribbon club along with Melbourne Victory, and then you'd probably go Western Sydney Wanderers would be the next biggest just because of where it is located. But again, their average crowds last year were 17,746. They're only 11,926 this year. So there's, again, almost a 6,000 drop there. And it's just really worrying. And I mean, the question I ask is, what is the problem with the A-League? Like, I mean, there's loads of people got theories that the standard's not that good, that we're seeing the same teams every year, there's no relegation, there's no promotion. There's a whole gamut of things that we're seeing players recycled. But whatever it is, the FFA need to do something about it. They need to start addressing this. And one of the things, if you look at it, when it started, they marketed it. They marketed the league brilliantly. They've spent nothing on marketing the league since. You know, they contributed to Del Piero's wages when he came over here, and that meant that Fox contributed so that they could use his image to promote. But again, Del Piero was finished by the time he came here. You know, I don't think he really...
What is the Del Piero legacy? I don't think there is one.
Yeah, I mean, it was a short-term fix.
No, it's not a sledge on him. Good on him. You know, he doesn't make these decisions as what the A-League goes, what direction they take and those sorts of things. But, you know, he was supposed to be the guy that kick-started all of that interest in Sydney. And as soon as he left, the interest dropped and just went... disappeared.
But then you've also got to look, John, is when he was here, Sydney didn't perform because he actually was detrimental to the team's performance because the guy couldn't run. You know, so that meant the midfield was having to work, those players around him had to work that extra bit harder to cover his deficiencies.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't agree with these big name signings. I don't think it was a good idea. I don't think it really helped enhance the A-League in any way. I think it's a major problem, but I just think, where is the A-League going? Where is it headed?
I think that the major problem they have is you can turn on television on a Saturday night and watch the Premier League. And that's what soccer fans are doing. They're watching European leagues. They're not supporting the A-League. They're not going to the games because they don't have to. They can get a better quality of product just by sitting at home.
I think the sad thing is, and this is my personal view, is that I think when the A-League started, if you look at the first 4 years, it got better every one of those 4 years. Then I think it sort of plateaued, and it was, well, so I think then it started to drop, and then it has since plateaued, and it hasn't maintained that growth or the improvement within the league, and that's one of the reasons. And yet people are pumping it up to be something that it isn't.
One thing that I constantly hear is about the television coverage. And I hear them going, oh, well, it's, you know, it's on Channel 10's minor stations. It's not on their number one station, you know, channel. What? How? It's pressing a button on a television remote control. There is no loss of the product or you know, because it's on one instead of 10. Like they said the same thing, oh, it's on SBS2. It's no one's watching it because it's on SBS2. No, no one's watching it because they're not interested in watching it. It is accessible. Just because it's on 32 instead of 30 doesn't mean people can't get it and don't know it's there. And constantly comes out from soccer journalists that, oh, we've got to get a better deal for television, you know, we're on these minor channels. No, those channels are exactly the same as their number one channels.
I have to agree with you, because Fox has got, I don't know how many channels, but no one goes, oh, that's a minor channel.
Exactly.
It's a channel.
It's what it is, and people have got just as much access to 32 or 1 or 13 as they do to 10 or 9 or 7.
But the thing, John, as well, and you touch on that with Fox, and this upset me, was, look, we all know that the A-League trophy is called the toilet seat. Now, they did an ad campaign about the finals, and it was people running in and stealing the toilet seats off, and then they're all sitting on the bus and whatever. And it was, the first time you saw it, I thought, oh, that's quite humorous. Then I thought, hang on a sec, though. This is the premier prize in this sport in the country. Now, it's unfortunate it looks like a toilet seat, but does it help having the host broadcaster belittling that trophy by having people stealing toilet seats and all of that? And I just think, to me, it felt like it was not respecting the prize that is up for grabs.
I just worry about the health, occupational health and safety aspects of handling toilet seats. Are these people properly kitted out in the right protective clothing?
Well, yeah, but anyway, the last thing I'm going to say on this subject as well is Fox Sports News, after the Johnny Warren medal and the Julie Dolan award was there. On Fox Sports News, they went, we'll be back after the break with Adrian Mizarewski, winner of the Dolan medal. Now, the Dolan medal is actually the female award. The Johnny Warren medal is the men's award. So you just think, here is again the host broadcaster and their news station can't even get that right. Now, that's just, to me, very disappointing. And I think it just sums up the last season in the A-League, which has just been, it'll be one that will be forgotten very, very quickly. I just hope the grand final is a good one.
Just one thing before we move on, and I might cop a little bit of criticism for having this point of view, but how long does Anzac Day go for? Because every sporting competition and jumps on Anzac Day, and it's now become a commercial opportunity for them. It is not a celebration of Australian spirit or whatever Anzac Day is supposed to be. When you have an Anzac Day on a Wednesday and the Friday beforehand, you have to sit and listen to national anthems, New Zealand and Australian national anthems, in an Australian domestic sporting competition. I just wonder if we haven't got this all tits about. Anzac Day is a one-off day that is very sacred in Australia and should be kept there.
And New Zealand,
yeah. It is not for sporting organisations to turn into commercial opportunities that run over a week. And it's really, really, really annoying me that they treat Anzac Day in that way.
You won't get any argument from me. To me, unless it happens on that day,
yeah,
that is it.
And don't take away from the primacy of this day trying to pretend that your sport has some intrinsic link to Anzac Day that none of the rest of us have. It's a joke.
Well, I would just say to our listeners, if you want to look at that, you should look at actually the sports who had their participants sign up to go to the First World War, and which ones were very quick to do it and which ones were not, because that was actually very interesting reading.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and it's now time for our guest. And as I mentioned at the top of this podcast, we have felt lately that it's been a really interesting tussle going on between athletes and their brand, the team that they maybe play for's brand, or the governing body or the National Association's brand. And obviously, what is a brand? You know, it's a very interesting concept. What is it? How does it affect it? How does your behaviour affect it? So we thought we'd try and find an expert who can actually maybe add some clarity to the whole situation. And I'm very pleased to say that we caught up with David Mitchell. Now, David is the principal consultant for DNA-RB, which is brand backwards. If you want to go to his website, it's DNA-RB.com. And he's helped various CEOs and sports people, championship winning teams, inventors and performers, and help them create a brand, and also teach them how to add value to their brands and also the perception of those brands in the marketplace. So we felt he was going to be a really good guy to talk to maybe add a little bit of clarity. David Mitchell, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, the reason we've got you on is we want to talk about the whole scheme of brands and sport. And I thought probably the best thing to do is maybe you can explain sort of what a brand is and sort of how important it is.
Certainly. Well, first of all, brands are quite misunderstood. Most people think of a brand as a logo, but actually a brand is just a thought and an emotion that you want to put inside your audience's head. So it's what you want people to think and feel about you or your product or your company. And so you create that thought and emotion by behaving in a certain way, or having having a certain style of communication, a certain identity, and all the things that you say, all of those things combine to leave that thought and emotion inside somebody's head. So to give you an example, say you were to go to a party, Ashley, and you walked into the party and said, "Hello, I'm Ashley, I'm funny," people would look at you slightly strangely. But if you went to the party and said, you had some jokes, you had a good time, everybody around you enjoyed themselves, and when you left, they went, that's Ashley, he's a funny guy, that's your brand. So it's doing things, it's saying things to try and leave a thought and emotion inside somebody's head. Now, you can't guarantee that that's what people are going to think, but that's what you try to achieve by being completely consistent and completely clear in the way you behave and communicate.
Right, so really people can be schooled to give them that impression of who they are or what their club is or their team by, as you say, following a consistent form of communication?
Absolutely, and it's the same as any corporate brand. So you, anywhere you go in the world, you'll see Coca-Cola and you'll see them behave in exact the same way. You'll see them in freezers or fridges wherever you go into shops. And when you open that can, you absolutely know what it's going to taste like. So they've set an expectation of what that product is in your mind. And they've also set an emotion in that if you drink it, you're going to feel refreshed. So that's just by being completely clear and completely consistent in everything that they do. It's no different for a sports team or an individual. If you want to have clarity about what people think and feel about you, you've got to be consistent in the way you behave, communicate, and identify yourself.
So it's one thing, and we know like a club like Manchester United and Barcelona, it really is a brand and everyone expects excellence in a certain form of behaviour. But I would think it's a lot harder maybe for less established clubs or whatever to force their way into having a brand that actually people can recognise straight away exactly what they're about.
Well, I think there are two things there. One is that if you are very successful as a team, then your awareness goes up. But if you're not clear in terms of and consistent in the way you communicate, then you don't really, lots of people know you, but they don't really understand what you stand for. So you look unfocused. Likewise, you can be very clear and focused on what you stand for, but not have achieved success to get the awareness. So it's a combination of the really strong brands have done two things. One is that they've been very clear and consistent in the way they set themselves up. And the other one is that they've achieved success. So it's that combination of success and clarity that builds the strong brand.
One of the things that I'm confused about at the moment is we've got athletes who obviously have their personal brands and they have individual sponsorship deals. And then you've got obviously clubs that have their brand and their sponsorship deals. Do you feel as someone that's sort of in that space that we're beginning to see now a battle of the brands? So between the player and the club as to who is the dominant or who is the stronger of the two brands?
I think it's been going on a long time and it's not so much a battle as trying to find balance. As players come up through their sport, they achieve a stronger awareness and a bigger following, and that creates brand value. And so obviously they, as individuals, are looking to try and maximize the value from that. But at the same time, the sport that they operate in has certain expectations of them in terms of participating and contributing to the sport overall. So it comes down often to very interesting discussions at a contract stage. where individual sports people are negotiating what they can and can't do within the restrictions of their sport or their team. And often it's, you know, if they're working in a sport environment or the team environment, then they, you know, their image rights belong to the team. But beyond the sport, if they've broken through and they're reaching an audience beyond the sport, then often the team will say, well, you know, go off and maximize your value from your individual brand beyond the sport, but don't do things that might bring the sport into disrepute. Don't do things with partners or sponsors that might conflict or compete with sponsors that we already have within the team. So there'll be restrictions on what a sports person can and can't do beyond their team environment. But I think in terms of, it works well when it's done at the contract stage and when there's good communication between the individual sports person and the team that they're working with.
Yeah, I mean, because that's one of the sort of things I was going to ask you about, because it seems at certain times the individual's personal views and opinions are not allowed to be aired because of obviously contractual obligations, and that's where we see some athletes get into trouble because they kind of have stepped over that agreed line that was probably in a contract.
Yeah, everybody has personal views. It's not always wise to express them. And whether, you know, again, that's exactly the same in the corporate world. If you sign for a big business, there will be an element in your contract about what you can and can't say to who outside, you know, in your normal everyday life. There'll be confidentiality. There'll be, morality clauses in contracts as well. So I think it's no different for a sports person than a business person. It's always better if you're in any doubt about what to say, then to say nothing is always the best option.
that's very true, and I've learned that lesson very late in life, I have to say. but I mean, again, going down that path, there's one of the things there that sometimes you feel that a sponsor has got on board with, say, an individual athlete because of their brand or their persona or who they sort of come across at, the way they play the game, and because they are maybe a little bit different or a little bit outrageous. Can that, again, then be when, if they get tied into sort of a social media policy, again, it just seems to me that it's suddenly a very grey area.
Well, it is, but actually, by, you know, having the team and the sponsor and the sports person all communicating well up front, then you plan this stuff and you sit down and you go, you work out what you can and can't say, you work out where the areas of opportunity that you can go and exploit are, and you then work out what you can do to make it interesting for the audience, make it fun and exciting, and you go and do the stuff that really works, and you're always conscious of the stuff that's going to cause an issue, and so you steer well clear of that. But all of these teams and individuals tend to have some fairly smart marketing and PR people behind them who can try and spot any issues ahead of the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's another sort of question that's come up recently is, you know, if an athlete has a very strong brand and, you know, they have that brand or that image is creating sponsorship opportunities for the sport as a whole, are they sort of, can they negotiate? Again, does it come down to a contract, or would say, for example, you've got a player at one club within a league situation. Now, the league itself is run separately from the club, but could that particular individual turn around and say to that league, hey, you know, I'm Lionel Messi, people watch La Liga because I'm a star, I want a bigger cut of your TV deal?
I'm sure he could try, but again, you know, it's in any sort of business agreement. This is where sport and business sort of start to overlap. So it starts to become less of a sporting issue and more of a business issue. And if somebody's value is such that a league really, really wants them, then they may well say, well, we'll give you a cut of the share. Likewise, they may turn around and say no, and that individual then needs to work out, well, you know, am I going to do it anyway, or do I take my brand and write somewhere else? So it's a negotiation, as in all things in business.
Yeah, and I suppose that probably is going to answer my next question, because we saw a case recently where the International Skating Union was trying to stop their athletes participating in non-ISU sanctioned events and were threatening to ban them. Now, surely again, I would think that comes down to the business side, communication, how it's been set up. But then you're sort of entering another field, aren't you, of preventing someone from earning a living?
Well, yes and no, but I think you have to put it, if you think about it from the governing body's perspective, that individual has a high profile and a strong brand value because of the investment that sport had made in that individual over the years and given that platform. And to a certain extent, it would be like a business saying, right, we're going to develop a product and have all the intellectual property rights and patents in that product. And then we'll suddenly that product of its own accord decides it's going to go and work for the competition. You can feel that there's a sense of we've built you up, and therefore, you know, we'd like to think that would create some loyalty and that you wouldn't disappear off. Now, obviously, to prevent that happening, they put rules in place as well.
Yeah, I know. It's quite a complicated area, isn't it, really, when you look at it?
It is, and I think, you know, each individual sport has a different thing. Where it gets very complicated is where you've got sports, you know, like rugby, where you've got club level and country level, and you know, you've got contracts at both levels, and that creates the tension. But I think in all of these things, it's always better to talk and negotiate than let the tension get out of control.
So is it a case of people like yourselves are becoming more and more important to act in an advisory role to a club or to a sporting organisation and to athletes individually as well?
I think there's certainly a role to play there, and part of that is helping teams and individuals define what their brands are. You're not creating a brand for them, but you're looking at what they stand for, and you talk to audiences and you find out what the audiences already think, and you look for the opportunities. And then it's a question of monitoring how that brand is being delivered and looking at the feedback from the audience, and trying to spot the reputational risks that lie in there, because brand and reputation have a very close relationship. Brand is what you want people to think and the expectation you set. Your reputation is how you actually deliver that. And if you deliver it well, and you meet or exceed the expectations you've set with people, then you have a great reputation. If you fall short of the expectations that you set, then your reputation suffers. So the role that I play is often not only helping people create their brands, but also manage their reputations.
That's a really interesting area, because obviously over here in Australia, we've had recently the ball tampering issue with the cricket. Now, everyone was saying, you know, Cricket Australia, their reputation's tarnished, their image or brand has been tarnished by the actions of these individuals. And as a result of that, you know, Cricket Australia and the individuals all lost sponsors. And you sort of think, wow, you know, how are they going to recover from this? But then less than a month later, they've now got a brand new billion-dollar TV deal, which would tend to imply that it takes a lot more to damage a brand than the incident that happened a month ago tampering the ball in South Africa.
I watch this really closely, because where you learn an awful lot when things go wrong, and learn lessons to apply to other sports that you're working with. So I think when you look at reputation damage, there are certain levels that you go through in terms of how the audience responds. The lowest level is sort of disappointment. People go, oh, that was a bit disappointing, but that's easy to recover from. It damages, and it's about the trust issue of damage to trust. So, disappointment is that. I'll recover from that. The next one up is surprise. And you go, oh, I'm a bit surprised that that was sort of, you know, what they did. And then you get to concern, which is really starts to really, where damage starts to get trust starts to get damaged. And then finally, you get up to the level of disgust, and at the top is outrage. You know, if people are outraged by it, then pretty much trust has been destroyed and it is very difficult to come back from. So when you look at the Australian ball tampering situation, Steve Smith reached outrage. He was the captain of the team. You know, he instigated it. He will not come back to top level cricket in a leadership role. He might play cricket, but no one will ever trust him again. And that is really damaging. Cameron Bancroft, you know, as a young player, and sort of there was almost an element of coercion in that, as far as I understand. You know, he got some sympathy, and I think it sort of, he was in the sort of concern discuss level. So he'll come back from that. I thought what was really interesting was the Australian Cricket Board. You know, they probably reached sort of surprise concern, but they'll come back from that. They didn't get quite so far up. But I think that raises another issue, which is how did they allow this to happen? And as a sports team, team management or a governing body, you should be setting an internal culture that this sort of thing, this reputational damage, should never be allowed to happen. And so I think this, you know, this probably is an issue where sports stars have got to the level of they start to believe their own brand. They start to believe that they can do what they like. They become untouchable, a sense of entitlement. And they've got caught up in the whole thing. And there isn't a culture within the team that they're working that acts as a counterbalance to that, that keeps them grounded, that prevents anything like this from ever happening. So I think, you know, actually the biggest villain in this is probably the Australian Cricket Board in allowing that culture to exist.
No, it's very interesting. I mean, one of the things, you know, basic on from that as well is, do you feel that some of these big organisations that, although they have a brand and all of that, it seems sometimes like it's a closed shop. Do you feel that there needs to be more transparency? So if somebody transgresses, especially now because they are on huge salaries and the punters who are paying their hard-earned cash to watch them, they want to see that the right punishments are meted out. But when we're told a player has been fined and an undisclosed amount and it will be donated to a charity, I think that gets some fans' backs up. Do you feel that, again, there is this obligation to be more transparent?
I think in every form of life at the moment, there's an obligation to be transparent. So you look in the world of business, you know, the same questions are being asked. And you know, the world is a very different place with social media. People have their opportunity to create comment and observation and social movements very, very quickly when things don't work. So I think transparency is going to be more and more important as you go forward. And I think that becomes the driving force between, you know, when you're creating brands, you're managing your reputation, you're supporting that with an internal culture. You get that cycle right. There shouldn't be a need for secrecy. You know, if you get that right and you're setting the right expectations, you're delivering against those expectations, you've got a culture that allows transparency and openness. There's no place for secrecy.
The other thing is, you touched on it earlier about image rights. Now, we saw the Australian cricketers negotiating about a year ago using their image rights to leverage a better deal with Cricket Australia. And you sort of touched on earlier saying that the image rights usually belong to the governing body or the sport that, you know, is actually running the competition. How does that work? And is that something that's almost a given? Or are there strong players with strong brands who they own their image rights and they would negotiate with the league? How does that one work?
Well, I think it's, you know, everybody owns their own image rights, but you give up some rights to go and do, you know, to work in certain places. So, you know, where I work, I give up a lot of rights to enable me to go and work in that space. So it comes down to the negotiation. Certain sports will say, well, we want your image rights. You don't have any rights at all as an individual in the sport, but beyond the sport. If you've transcended the sport, then obviously you can go and do your own negotiations, but don't allow it to compete. So it does come down to individual sports, discussions with individuals. You know, some sports stars do transcend and reach beyond sport. And that's where it starts to get complicated in terms of image rights. If you're a sort of a lower level player whose image is rising because of the sport and because of the investment the sport has made in you, then I think it's fair that you give up your rights and until you reach a point where actually, you know, you've got something to debate and discuss.
No, I totally agree with that one. I think that makes sense. I suppose, David, because we're running out of time, but I could go on forever because it's fascinating stuff. But do you then, in sort of summary, not see it as really a battle of the brands? It's more a case of sitting around a table and actually negotiating and common sense prevailing?
I'd like to think so, because the sums of money involved are very large, and you need to make sure that you understand where the boundaries are. You've got sports people, you've got teams, you've got sponsors, all of whom are trying to get different things. And unless you have that written down and you understand where the boundaries are, then you end up with the potential for chaos. So, getting the negotiation right at the beginning and then, having a good open discussion as things go on, it doesn't prevent, opportunities coming up and you saying, well, let's go and try this or let's do that. But, getting it down in writing and agreed up front is very important.
Well, David, thank you very much for your time and thank you for your very concise explanation of a very tricky subject.
It's been a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Mark Aduka and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, that was
my favourites.
And Mark Viduka.
Oh yeah, love Mark Viduka.
Well, that was David Mitchell from DNA-RB, brand backwards, and John, some really interesting things in that. And I thought he explained it so simply and really well that to me that the thing that came out of that was that you need to be consistent, you need to be clear, and of course success plays a part in you developing that brand. And I thought it was really interesting how he said there needs to be a balance between the player, the club, the national association, and also there needs to be communication.
There does. I think sports have got to understand where they are. Sports aren't our moral guidance. If I want to know about spirituality, I don't go to a sports administrator. If I want to find out how to trap a hockey ball, I might. And I just think that there's a bit of a disconnect now between sport and reality in the sense that they think that they're something bigger and better than what they are.
Yeah, but I think as David was alluding to there, sport is now business, which you've always said. And it's trying to actually, for sport to understand that it is business and to adopt business practices. Now, again, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was when he talked about the Australian cricket team. And he said that there was no counterbalance for the culture within the team and within Cricket Australia. And he said what had happened there was that the players got to the point that they believed that they were bigger and they could do whatever they wanted. And there was nothing within the organisation to counterbalance that. Now, if you're in a business situation, you know that there is that counterbalance and that you can't in a lot of places get away with that. And that's maybe where sport is needing to adapt to that business side, that it has always been run as a sport, but now if we want it to be a big business, then we need to start adapting some of those business things to make sure that things like the ball tampering don't happen again.
And I think the whole Israel Folau episode that's going on at the moment has created an interesting situation for sports and for sponsors in that matter, because here's a guy that has very strongly held beliefs, and good on him. I mean, I'm not going to tell him that his beliefs are wrong, even though I might think they are.
But that's just a matter of opinion, and we're all entitled to opinions.
That's exactly right. And from what I can gather, I think that all that Israel did was stand up for what he believes in. I believe this, and he stated it, and that's where he's left it. He hasn't been out in the marketplace promoting another argument. He's just said, this is what I think, and left it there. And good on Israel. He's allowed to have his opinion about these sorts of things. I may or may not agree with him. I don't on this particular occasion, but I do believe he has the right to be able to say those sorts of things without getting a comeback from a sponsor of a sport. Not the sports administration itself, because they basically didn't really care. But it was only when Qantas started piping up and got a little bit upset that rugby suddenly had a problem with what Israel said. Oh, well, we're all inclusive. We do this, we're all inclusive. Well, yeah, that means including people with fundamentalist Christian belief. That's what inclusive means.
Absolutely. It's got to, we've got to embrace everybody. It was interesting, again, that David said in that interview that, you know, sometimes it's better to not say anything to protect your brand. But obviously, if it's something that you feel strongly about, you should be allowed to, if you wish, to state your view. And obviously, in this case, Israel feels that strongly that he wanted to say something. So why should we muzzle somebody from saying that, as you say? I mean, he's not advocating going out and killing people or anything like that, so there is no major problem with it.
When you stand on your moral high horse, get ready for it. Be aware that, you know, you're obviously going to come under attack for some whatever reason. And when, especially if you're a sponsor like Qantas and you go and hang your attack dogs out on people's beliefs and morality, then you're going to have a good hard look at your own backyard. Now, Qantas, it's all very well and good for Qantas to give Izzy a slap over his statements, but I don't see them doing the same thing to the Emirates airline, who are their partner. Now, Emirates have the Emirates, not the airline, the place, the Emirates, we'll call it that, from, they've got a terrible, 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 terrible record with dealing with homosexual people, with their treatment of women, with their treatment of foreigners. Let's see how far through the list we can go before we come up with something that Qantas might actually say, oh no, that's not good enough, we can't have that.
Thanks, you know? John, you just killed our sponsorship opportunities with both those carriers. No, I'm only joking. But no, I hear exactly what you're saying.
You know, you can't stand on the moral high horse and then ignore what's going on in your backyard. And in the case of Qantas, just shut up and fly people.
No, I think that's true. And the other thing that I found interesting as well in that, because to me, this is a major thing, and again, we touched on it in that interview with David, is transparency. Now, I've always been of the belief, or I was brought up with the belief, that if you've got nothing to hide, then there's nothing wrong with being transparent about stuff. You just tell people what's going on. Now, the minute you start doing things that are not correct, or you try to cut corners, that's when the transparency starts to go. And when you're doing things that aren't necessarily above board, there's that lack of transparency. Now, I don't like to see in sport these, he was fined an undisclosed sum.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, no, to me that is wrong, especially if, you know, I'm buying a membership or I'm going to watch this person. If they have transgressed and they're going to be fined, the fine should be clear. And I also believe, and the instance we're talking about here is the president of the FIH, who, for comments he made that were inappropriate a year ago, they were his own personal comments, but they were deemed inappropriate for a president of a sport. Now, he has been fined an undisclosed fee to be donated to a charity of his choice. Now, to me, that is unsatisfactory. And it would be unsatisfactory if it was the president of FIFA, president of the FFA, president of Football West. It should be public how much he was fined for those comments, and also the charity that that is donated to. Now, in fact, to me, I would actually maybe not put it to a charity, but I would give it to either youth development and make sure it was ploughed into that area so it was stayed within the sport. So it was invested into... I mean, we see players giving community service. Maybe the president could actually come down and help a club and actually put the lines or something like that. Now, I know that's being ridiculous, but you see players having to do community service for their transgression, so why shouldn't administrators? And I just think this is a really, really dangerous area. If this is not transparent, and I'll tell you why this is dangerous, because England hockey were the ones who were embarrassed by the comments because they were hosting the tournament at the time and the aspersions were cast on English politicians and the English police force.
Well, now, basically the English democratic system.
Yeah. Now, I know for a fact that the British government, who obviously gives funding to England hockey, wanted an explanation from England hockey saying, you know, please explain how the head of your sport can come here and make these comments. Now, how is the chair of England Hockey or the CEO of England Hockey going to be able to go back to the government in England and say now, oh, he was fined an undisclosed amount of money and to a charity, and they'll go, which charity? I don't know, because it's secret. Now, that's not a satisfactory outcome.
No.
And it could have an impact on their funding. Now, we're using this as an example, but to me, this happens far too often in sport.
Well, Dr. Batchelor's got to go. Straight up, and it would be very easy to say, oh, look at the comments he made, they're terrible, oh, get rid of him, get rid of him. Okay, we all make stupid statements on social media at times, I'm sure he regrets it, and, you know, wasn't the smartest thing to do. They've decided to fine him, they should tell us how much the fine is and where it's going, but that's their disciplinary action. Fine, fair enough, a lot of people were upset and said, oh, it's pathetic, it's not enough. Maybe.
What, well, we don't know how much it is.
That's right. What worries me more is that Dr. Batra's been missing for months, since November. We've heard nothing. All we've heard about Dr. Batra is the fact that he's been elected to the Indian Olympic Committee president, or head of the Indian Olympic Committee. Where are you, Dr. Batra? See, the thing about being elected a leader is you're supposed to lead. And at a time when hockey was going through crisis, and yes, it is a crisis at the moment, he's gone missing. That, to me, says Dr. Batra's got to go, because he's not doing the job for hockey, he's not showing any leadership, and the sport's going to ruin because of the lack of leadership being shown by him.
I have to say, I mean, at that time, and I think it was probably December, John, you said November, because we had the Hockey World League finals. It was after that that Jason McCracken resigned. It was after that that Sarah Massey, who was the 2IC, had resigned. David Luckers, who was in the other 2IC position, had not been replaced. So that was when the organisation was leaderless at that point.
And that's when he had to stand up.
Yep.
And he didn't. He went missing. And he went off and got his job at the Indian Olympic Committee. That's what he's really after. And that's shown up by the fact that Dr. Batra invited Thomas Bach to India recently for a Hockey Fives tournament. What's the head of the IOC doing at a Hockey Fives tournament in India? Why would he be there as a guest of Dr. Batra? Well, that's because Hockey Fives is going to be at the Olympics 2024.
Well, I mean, I've got to be honest, now there's rumours that T20 is going to be in the Olympics, and I tell you what, if the IOC put T20 in the Olympics, that's the end of my viewing of the Olympics.
A five-a-side T20, I hope, because, you know, if 11 is too much for hockey, why would 11 be not too much for cricket?
Yeah, and don't forget, you'll need a bigger squad than 11, though.
Will
because
it be under 23s?
Yeah, look, I think the IOC's lost the plot as well, personally. I just think what they're turning the Olympics into, Baron Pierre de Coubertin would be, well, he'd be like a drill in his grave at the moment, the amount he's spinning.
Yeah, I agree with you, and it's become a joke.
Yeah, it's become a farce.
And sadly, the sports that most need the Olympics are going to suffer the most from that. And I'm talking sports like athletics. Sadly, I mean, we've heard this morning that the last couple of days, the International Athletics Federation is changing its rules regarding qualifications and levels of testosterone in female athletes, but only for certain events. Not for all events. They're not just going to have a blanket, if your testosterone level's at this, bang, you're out. You can't compete against other women. Only in certain events. So you can essentially be a man in one event and qualify and win a gold medal, but not so much in another event. I don't understand where they're going with that.
I think they're entering a minefield with that one.
Oh,
legally, I would think.
Yeah, and look, let's face it, it's going to come up more and more in the future, as more and more transgender people decide that they want to be competing as their.
Well, I think a society now as well accepts transgender people far more than they did 20 years ago. Then we're going to see them come to the fore more in sports.
But I think it's also opening up a horrible Pandora's box, because if someone's male, say, until they get to 23 years old and suddenly change themselves into a female, and they're competing against females who've been a female all their life, completely different bodies, things going on with bodies and the way you work and your strength and your power and all that sort of stuff, and it's going to get worse. There will be more and more people saying, no, this is not fair, I don't want to compete against this person because it's not a level playing field.
That's very, very complex, John, and I think it's far too difficult for us. Before we wrap up, do you remember we were talking, though, about the Olympic Games, and we were saying how it had got ridiculous? I think it was on the last show, and we said, who won the tennis? And I was like, oh, yeah, I better look that up. It was actually Andy Murray won it again.
Did he? Oh, yeah. There you go.
So I think he beat Martin Del Potro in the final.
What a memorable event that was.
See ya. We'll be back next week.